Hi there, my name is Roland Krüger and I'm the president of Infinity Motors Corporation. Today we're here in sunny California to introduce our new Q60, our latest coupe that we will introduce in the market this month. Welcome to Autoline After Hours.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vassilash, episode 352 for October 21 of 2016, Tenneco, Tesla, and Technology. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Hey, it's Autoline After Hours time, Mr. Vassilash.
It is, you know, and he's in Southern California, and we're not.
No, we're in rainy Michigan.
We are.
That's right.
Fall is here.
It is. But hey, we got to let everybody know that we got Joni Gray in the studio with us from AutoVitel.
Glad to be here.
From Southern California.
Just there 2 days ago. I'll go tomorrow.
And you're going back, too. Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
And so Joni's been on the show before, but not in the studio. So it's great to have you here.
No, it's the first.
And, of course, our special guest today we've got to let everybody know about, and that's Tim Jackson, the CTO, the Chief Technology Officer for the giant supplier company, Tenneco. And Tim, welcome to After Hours.
Well, thank you very much.
So, very quickly, and we'll get into a whole lot of things here to talk about, but just bring all our viewers up to speed. Tenneco, you guys have a bunch of automotive brands. Monroe shock absorbers are part of your portfolio. What else?
That's correct. Monroe shock absorbers, of course, it's an iconic brand. It's sold around the world as a global brand, and I still remember I was on a trip to Japan about 10 years ago, met a colleague from a former industry in the lobby of the hotel, and he says, Jackson-san, I understand you're now with the great American company Monroe. I said, yeah, that's correct. He says, great, I need shocks for my wife's Mercedes.
Yeah.
And so I do get hit up a bit as I travel around the world for shock absorbers. But beyond that, we've got our clean air division, which is probably best known by its aftermarket brand, Walker. We've got
Walker mufflers,
and of course, Dynamax and Thrush, a couple of our performance brands within the aftermarket as well. And then finally, within our Ride Performance group, we've not only got Monroe shock absorbers, but we've got Clevite elastomers, and we just recently showed some new branding and some new logos at the Hanover Truck Show for our Clevite brand. And again, there are synergies here because not only can we give you an after-treatment system that gives you clean air, we can also give you the mounting and the isolation for that system to mount it to your light truck or car. And so we increasingly, you know, see opportunities to do that, and our customers are kind of embracing that one-stop shopping approach.
So we at the show open, as you saw, we had the guy from Infinity with the Q60 behind him. I just got a chance to drive it, but that's your suspension system on that car.
Yeah, we're extremely proud of that. That's our new Monroe Intelligent Suspension. It's a continuously variable semi-active shock absorber system. It actually adjusts itself over 100 times a second based on everything from inputs from the accelerometers at the four corners of a vehicle, the steering angle sensor, even the brake pedal. You know, we can actually control pitch and dive with that technology under hard acceleration or hard braking. And again, we're able to break the compromise between a great ride and great handling. And I understand you had the opportunity to drive that vehicle.
Yeah, I drove the Sport.
As did you, Joni.
Today. The Sport version, which is that 3-liter turbo in it, it is a wicked fast car.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How does the system adjust so quickly?
Yeah, basically we've got an electronic valve within that shock absorber, and there is a separate chassis control computer that actually processes all of these different signals through a series of algorithms. It's high-speed computer, and then We send an electronic signal to each one of the four corners that we actually adjust the damping rate of the shock absorber, both in compression and rebound. And so in a typical shock absorber, you know, you've got a tuning curve that you put in that adjusts the damping force of a shock absorber as a function of the velocity of the wheel movement or the velocity of the piston rod. Here we're able to take a lot more inputs, and we're frankly able to have a very sophisticated computer algorithm that can figure out, well, what do I want to do to give the best ride comfort and at the same time maintain that contact between the tire and the road so that I maximize the ability of the vehicle to have steering, stopping, and handling.
So for a normal shock absorber, as you encounter uneven surfaces, there's basically a range that things can be adjusted within.
Yeah, most shock absorbers are mechanical, and they have a static tuning. They have one particular tuning curve.
Okay.
With the electronic shock absorber, we can generate a whole range of tuning curves from extremely soft to extremely firm, and therefore we can pick the right tuning curve for the speed of the vehicle and the acceleration of the four wheels. And again, that's all done through a pretty sophisticated computer algorithm that Tenneco creates. And then we port that software onto the vehicle's suspension controller.
Tim, talk a little bit about where it's going, because I know you guys are working on not just adaptive suspensions, but
right.
Active. We're actually putting energy into the suspension. And I know you guys, I want to say in the next few years, you might have something up your sleeve on that.
Well, we've already got demonstration vehicles that we've got our customers in. And you're absolutely right, John, that, you know, a shock absorber today basically controls the energy release, if you will, in both compression and rebound. And now it's no longer just a damper. It's going to actually be a hydraulic actuator, but it's going to be powered by a separate energy source. Think of it like an electric power steering pump that generates hydraulic energy. And now we can actually tune that ride not just in compression and rebound. We can actually force the wheel to go opposite its normal direction of travel. For example, if you're coming across a pothole, we can actually lift the wheel up above the pothole so it will never drop into the pothole. If you've got a sudden dip in the road, or if you're doing a very aggressive cornering maneuver where you might, you know, be unloading the tire, we can actually push the tire down against the road to maintain near equal tire contact patch on all four wheels. And the beauty of this is we can really produce a ride quality far beyond anything that can be done today. And in fact, I call it the magic carpet ride. I've heard customers describe it as a train-like quality. And particularly in light of what's happening with autonomous vehicles, you know, we're going to be using the cars of the future for things beyond just transportation, because the car might be driving itself in a future vision. And now you want to use it as a mobile office. And even though people say, okay, well, yeah, I sit in the back seat today and I use my cell phone. Let's be real. You know, it's not always easy.
You're moving all around.
You're moving all around. It's not easy. You can read your email, but typing an email, that's a little different story, right? And in the vehicle of the future, we're going to have a train-like quality ride, and that not only helps avoid things like motion sickness, it enables,
it'll help your
increases
timing.
In productivity. Yeah, so.
Even trains are kind of, sorry.
Well, no, go ahead, John.
Even trains are kind of shaky.
Yeah,
I bet it could be a lot smoother on tires.
We can do better than a tire.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right, Joni.
Yeah. So I drove my first fully active suspension car back in the mid-80s, and Lotus Engineering had built one for GM Research.
Yeah.
Used a Corvette. The reason they used a Corvette is it took 50 horsepower to run the system.
Yeah.
Where do you stand today on energy consumption?
Yeah, we're way below that. And in fact, we're under a horsepower.
Wow.
Today, yeah. And in fact, it depends on a couple things. It depends on how smooth or rough the road is. But we can actually get the average energy demand of the corner down in the vicinity of 100 to 150 watts, and I think it's 700 watts per horsepower or something like that. So, you know, we're under a horsepower today. And again, that has been the thing limiting active suspension is the mass, the energy consumption, and frankly, the computing power.
So this is not reactive as systems generally are today. It's proactive.
It can be very proactive, especially when you consider that an autonomous vehicle might have some type of forward-looking vision, will have some type of forward-looking vision. And in fact, there's...
So you can see the potholes coming,
you
is what you're saying.
You can see it coming, and you know, today we operate, again, off from four-corner accelerometers. So you actually have to start to move the wheel before we can react to that. In the future, we'll actually be able to look forward, see an obstacle coming or a pothole coming, and we'll be able to react before we hit it. And you say, well, how precise is that? Well, at 60 miles an hour, we can see an object plus or minus 2 millimeters in front of us. And so the electronics, the algorithms to do that, and frankly, autonomous vehicles are going to create an infrastructure where we can take a vehicle suspension and make it far better and a far better value proposition than it is today. Not that it isn't great today, as evidenced
but,
by
but
that
what you're talking about is you can't do what you're talking about with today's suspension.
That's right, you can't. And that's why the future is exciting. And you know, I'm kind of proud of the fact we saw that coming. And we created this thing called the Monroe Scalable Architecture. And if I had the three units in my hand, you would look at them and you'd say, okay, they're all the same size. They all have the same attach points. They all have the same physical envelope when you're have a suspension. But it's better, best, ultimate. This one is fully active. You know, this one is semi-active, and this one is adaptive. And so you can choose. And once you've built that architecture into your vehicle, it's very easy to decide what level of suspension you want without having to re-engineer the vehicle.
So it could be a trim level for a car.
It can be a trim level. It can be an option package. It can be standard equipment at one level and an option package at a higher level. Mm-hmm. And so we really think that the scalable architecture of Monroe Intelligent Suspension is going to help define the future of where vehicles go with suspension systems.
One of the subjects we've been talking about on the show for the last several weeks, it seems, is 48-volt systems.
Yeah.
Does this require 48-volt?
It doesn't require. We can operate on almost all vehicles with a 12-volt system, and we only really face a limitation on the heaviest vehicles today, light trucks and really heavy sport utility vehicles, where we start to trip over the point where we really can't get there with 12 volts. But 48 volts will be a cost reduction. It'll be an enabler. It's going to allow us to make things even lighter, going to have smaller conductors, smaller wiring harnesses, better transient response with 48 volts. And so 48 volts will just take a great system and make it even more affordable.
What's it do for performance cars? You talked about smoothing it out for autonomous ones. I got to believe this would really enhance any kind of sports car.
It will, but it's not just a system for a sports car. I mean, we make some great systems today. We're on the McLaren, for example, with our continuously variable, semi-active, and kinetic combination. And, you know, we're very proud of the fact that we've helped McLaren get, you know, Formula One type performance on a car that you can still drive on the street and have an enjoyable ride experience. So we can do that today. What these next-generation technologies are going to do is bring it into the mainstream. It's going to make it affordable for cars even in the C segment and below. And so, you know, I think that at the end of the day is where we want to go, particularly when you consider the safety benefits here. And I don't know if you saw the video that we sent you, John, but we actually did a simulation on one of those videos of a light pickup truck where we did what's called the fish hook maneuver, where you're doing a sudden avoidance, and we showed how the electronic suspension actually helps you avoid a skid event. It enables you to actually turn and maximize your performance on there. And as such, now it's not just ride and comfort. There's a safety aspect to this too. And again, we look forward to the day when some of these systems can be standard.
Tim, there's so much movement in electric cars, hydrogen-fueled cars,
yeah,
and the like. You guys are in the business of cleaning up emissions of internal combustion engines. What's the future look like for you?
You know, frankly, I think the future looks bright. And I remind everyone that the battery electric vehicle or the hydrogen fuel cell vehicle is chasing a moving target. And the moving target that it's chasing is a world of internal combustion that's far more efficient and far cleaner than it is today. You know, we're right in the middle of implementing the U.S. Tier 3 emission standards. And when we get done, a 2025 vehicle is going to the fleet average will be at what's called a BIN 30 level of emissions. That's about 90% cleaner than today. And I like to, one of my favorite sayings is, you know, we're already to the point, if you're driving a 2017 model vehicle in a city like Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, you're already helping clean the air of hydrocarbons as you're driving the vehicle, because the emissions coming out the tailpipe are actually cleaner than the ambient background air that's going into the air filter. Well, by 2025, we're not only going to be doing that for hydrocarbons, we're going to be doing it for NOx and for particulate matter as well. So we're actually going to be cleaning the air as we drive the vehicle. And so if you're driving a battery electric vehicle, you're not helping clean the air.
All right. So if we were to go, okay, so we're looking 8 years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If we were to go 8 years in the past,
mm-hmm.
what state were we at in terms of vehicular cleanliness?
Yeah, well, we've come a long way. I mean, 8 years ago, you didn't have selective catalytic reduction, for example, on your light diesel vehicles. And I'm driving one today. It's out in the parking lot. And if you look at how much cleaner that vehicle is today versus where it was 8 years ago, we've already made it about 90% cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, fuel economy has gotten better at the same time. You know, we used to have this debate that, well, you can have clean air or you can have great fuel economy. And now the industry's learned how to have both. We've broken that tyranny of the or and created that genius of the and. And so I'm extremely proud of the fact I just got back from Tenneco's operations in Germany. And, you know, one of the big issues in Europe is what's called real driving emissions. And people say, well, okay, this vehicle was certified in the laboratory to be very clean, but then when we drive the vehicle on the real road, we find out that the real driving emissions are a factor of 7 times greater than the certified emissions.
It's all about defeat devices.
Well, it's not just defeat devices. It's everything from how you calibrate the system to how you manage we call it thermal management. How do you manage the heat in the system? How do you deal with rapid transients of an aggressive driver? And
so what does that mean?
Well, for example, when you certify a vehicle in the test lab, there are very prescribed speed and load schedules that you drive through. And so we calibrate an emission system in order to meet the requirements of those speed and load curves. And for example, the World Light Test Protocol has got everything from a city driving cycle to a highway driving cycle, and you calibrate the system to meet that. But then when you go out in the real world, someone who drives their vehicle gently versus someone who puts the pedal to the metal, so to speak. Hey, not pointing any fingers, but Gary is.
Gary's pointing a thumb.
Gary is pointing a thumb. The fact is that in the real world, that can result not only in differences in fuel economy, which we all know, but it can result in differences in tailpipe emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And so now the key is, how do we become more robust in the future? How do we have better thermal management? How do we have better software control mechanisms? How do we have better catalyst coatings? And the good news is that the Tenneco team in Germany showed me a system that actually goes into production next year, where our conformity factor, our ratio of real-world emissions versus certified emissions, is 0.5. So we're actually better than the certified emissions in the real world. And again, that's not something that's 8 or 10 years away. That's a system we're going to put into production next year.
Is this for a diesel engine or a gas?
It's for a diesel engine, yeah. Yeah, so again, we like to say that the diesel engine did nothing wrong. and the technology is there that we can have clean diesel, and we can have clean diesel not just during the certified schedule in the lab. We can have it in real driving emissions, and Tenneco's really busy right now putting systems into production that achieve that. We were proud of the fact we're the provider to the new diesel Colorado and Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
And relatively late in that certification cycle, that vehicle was actually taken on real roads and subjected you know, to real driving emissions, and it passed with flying colors, and we're happy to have contributed to that.
So, Tim, what you're really saying is that the internal combustion engine is probably going to be around a lot longer than a lot of people think.
Gosh, I hope so. I hope so. You know, I'm a bit of a car nut.
We're going to get into that in a minute here too.
I love working on internal combustion engines, not just for cars and trucks, but snowmobiles. In fact, one factoid about me is, you know, here I am, Chief Technology Officer at Tenneco. I just went to the Michigan Secretary of State about 4 months ago and sat for the Master Mechanics licensing exam. And I passed on the first try because I honestly, and you're going to laugh when you hear this, I tore my first engine apart when I was 8 years old.
Wow.
I was the mini bike mechanic for the local
neighborhood.
I was working on Tecumseh and Briggs and Stratton, you know, 5-horsepower engines and mini bikes, helping figure out how we could make those go faster. And so the good news, John, is now I can work on your motorcycle and charge you for it.
We need to take a quick commercial break right now. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about what you're working on and also some cars in your collection, too,
Great.
Not just cars. So we got to get into that. But right now we're going to give a shout-out to our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back.
You know, another apropos commercial, John, you know, I actually own 2 race cars, and we participate in a Rally America event in northern Michigan called Snowdrift every year.
Which has been going on forever.
It's an iconic race.
In fact, I think we got a picture of that,
car,
the white Mitsubishi. There we go.
Yeah, that's a Mitsubishi VR4 Galant. It's an all-wheel drive. And I believe those are Bridgestone Blizzaks you see right there. We actually have 3 different compounds of ice and snow tires based on, is it icy, is it wet heavy snow, or is it light fluffy snow? And the Bridgestone Blizzaks are, you know, our all around tire when you're going to have changing conditions.
What was on the front of the car?
Headlines. Those are actually
torpedo tubes.
They're actually
let's bring the picture back up.
They're actually the ultimate high beam there,
wow.
Gary.
Wow.
Because we about a third of that race happens at night after dark, and you got a million or so candle power hung on the hood of that car. That's
like
actually
inches,
a quick detach pod. You can mount that pod in about 1 minute. It's just got some Zeus type fasteners. It's quick attach, and you hop out, plug it in, and you light up the space in front of you.
So it's a rally race?
Rally race, and the average winning speed on that race on ice and snow is over 100 miles an hour.
Wow.
That's the average speed.
Fast.
So you can, in fact, my younger son is driver of our other car. We've got a former Neon Challenge car that I was telling you about.
Yeah.
A Dodge Neon American Competition Racer, the same one that won ran in the Neon Challenge. He drives that car, and he went off course, which means he actually left the road. Fortunately, that car's got a full skid plate, and he was like a toboggan for about 200 yards on top of the snow until he came to the next corner and popped right back on the road. So found out that, you can sled in a rally car.
Wow.
And so, but the Neon Racer is for road courses, right?
Well, we run in Snowdrift, too. In fact, we've got the Michigan Vanity Plate Snowdrift on that particular car because we're one of the local teams. You know, you have a lot of international teams, including teams from overseas.
Come to that race?
Yeah.
Northern Michigan?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I was telling John, I just started that car up 2 days ago because my younger son is out of his master's program now, and we're going to get the team back together. So hopefully you'll see us January of this year up in Lewiston and Alpena and Hillman, Michigan, as part of a Snowdrift.
In fact, if I remember right, Snowdrift sort of evolved out of the Press-On Regardless rally,
I think.
And for those who don't know, the Press-On Regardless rally in Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, actually counted for the World Rally Championship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember when Lancia Stratoses were racing around up there.
Yeah, in fact, there's another Rally America event in the Upper Peninsula, the Lake Superior run, and that was just this last weekend. We saw a lot of cars coming back on Sunday from that event, so There's two local races out of a series that are done here in Michigan.
Okay, so you got a couple of race cars. You got other stuff, though, too.
Yeah, I do.
You got, a Model A? No, a couple of Model A's,
I've got a
right?
couple Model A's, 28 Roadster and a 29 pickup truck.
I think we got a picture of one of the Model A's, too.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, that's the
Roadster.
Agra blue and French gray. And the purist, Model A purist, will say, hey, that car's got a few features that... The 28 Model A didn't come standard with, like side mounts on both sides. But you know what?
We side mounts for what?
The spare there.
Tire?
Yeah, we built the car the way we wanted to build it. So, you know, we're happy with it. Yeah. I took it to a couple car shows, decided I would need a good psychologist if I continued. And so now we just enjoy the car.
Uh-huh. Good.
And what else? You got a fire engine.
Yeah, I've actually got, this is a little embarrassing, you know, it says I'm a bit OCD, I've got four fire engines.
What?
Yeah, I've got four fire engines. That particular one is my pride and joy.
What's that?
That's a 1993 Four Guys fire truck. It's all stainless steel, and that truck is still under warranty. It came with a 25-year warranty until 2018, and that's built on a GMC Brigadier chassis. It's a 10-liter Caterpillar. Allison automatic transmission. And why in the world do I own fire trucks? It's because in my spare time, I'm a tree farmer. And we actually own a little tree farm called Conifer Crossing. And we raise pines, firs, and spruces. And that's my irrigation system. And so that particular truck, that one can load about 1,200 gallons of water. I can just park it at one corner of the field, and I can spray... 250 to 300 feet, and I'm actually looking for a water cannon. That truck is plumbed for a water cannon, and they took it off before they sold it, so if I get that water cannon, I can probably go 300 or 400 feet.
Then you need a hook and ladder so you can do all the tree trimming, too.
Yeah, well, they're not that tall, you know. We can still reach the trees, so that's not the problem, but ironically, ever since I bought that fire truck, I haven't had to water at all because we've had such wet summers here in Michigan. But
so do you drive it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You should bring it out to California and give
us
some water.
Yeah, I should. Yeah, it's a blast to drive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've actually, you know, it is a working farm, so it's plated as a farm vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
I've always heard that you can buy old fire trucks fairly cheap.
In fact, I got one for sale, John, if you want to talk after the show. But yeah, they're incredibly affordable because there's not a huge demand. And again, I give these retired fire trucks a good home. I don't chop them up and sell them for scrap metal. And so I just bought another one up north in Lewiston from a local fire department and actually picked that up next week.
Wow.
And that one is a Ford F800 diesel. Yeah, so I'm slowly replacing my fleet of gasoline engine trucks with all diesels.
That's terrific. Yeah, you buy them cheap, but then you put a bunch of money into getting them running again, right?
No, not really. I mean, the last two I bought were straight out of service, and they were maintained and certified, you know, to fire department standards, so they were plug and play. They were ready to go. I didn't have to spend hardly any money at all, you know. So,
you know, I want to ask you one thing. So before getting this job by a couple earlier, You were in Asia Pacific.
I was Shanghai.
So what's your sense of the auto scene there versus the auto scene here?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I went to Shanghai and China in 2005, we were talking about the day when China would actually produce more light vehicles than North America. I didn't think it would happen when I was there, but it did. And I still remember when we surpassed that mark. And, you know, we're proud of the fact that, you know, Tenneco's got probably the best footprint in China of any clean air and ride performance company. But very little of that product is exported. You know, over 99% of what we produce in China is consumed in China for the local market consumption. And, you know, again, based on the nature of our products, our clean air products, we start at the manifold of the engine, we go all the way to the tailpipe. These things don't transport easily and they don't transport densely. I mean, let's face it, a muffler's full of air, right? And so Tenneco's always been a very good company about spotting strategically, you know, where do we need to be in the world and getting there early and you know, helping our customers, produce their global vehicles wherever they choose around the world.
Mm-hmm. But there wouldn't be an analog of you owning 4 fire trucks there, would there?
No, there wouldn't. In fact, it killed me. I'm a motorcycle enthusiast, too. And, at the time, you couldn't even have a Harley-Davidson on the streets of China. And I was fortunate because I was not just general manager of a China operations. I was all Asia Pacific, so I kept 2 Harleys down in Australia. And that was pretty glorious when I visited Australia.
That's great. Tim, we've come to that part of the show. I want to thank you for having come on.
Well, thank you, John.
Very interesting. I love your breadth of interests and knowledge in the industry. So thanks for sharing
with us. And if you guys want to ride in a fire truck and a new Christmas tree, we have some beautiful blue spruces.
Okay.
We do.
Yeah.
Give me a call.
Okay.
Come on down and pick your tree. It's free.
And
we'll give you a ride in a fire truck at the same time.
You have to chop it down.
Yeah. I live
What's
here.
That?
You have to chop the tree down.
We'll take care of that for you.
Yeah.
We'll handle that for you.
Cool.
Okay, thank you.
Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And want to let everybody know we're going to take a quick break right now and come back, talk about some of the news that's been going on in this industry this week.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
Some big news from Tesla this week. We may as well talk about news and what we've been doing and all that sort of thing. And they claim they are going to have a fully autonomous car. Or their cars are going to be capable with that. Joni, what do you think? Is this going to catch on for them or
so
what?
This was the announcement then. I somehow missed that. Okay, that's good. Mm-hmm. I mean, what they're the closest to it, right? And they're the ones taking all the heat. So to me, it's just like, hey, go for it all the way, Elon. Don't, hold anything back. You're our poster child and our, guinea pig for all things future. So,
here's the thing I don't get. So they announced 8 surround cameras, 12 updated ultrasonic sensors, a forward-facing radar, and a new onboard computer with more than 40 times the computing power of the existing one. Okay, so
upgrade.
This is all good, right? I mean, it just all sounds fantastic.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, but here's the thing that I don't understand. Okay, and this is from Tesla. Okay, before activating the features enabled by the new hardware, we will further calibrate the system using millions of miles of real world driving to ensure significant improvements to safety and convenience. While this is occurring, Teslas with new hardware will temporarily lack certain features currently available on Teslas with first generation autopilot hardware, including some standard safety features as automatic emergency braking, collision warning, lane holding, and active cruise control. So does that mean that you buy the new one and it doesn't do the stuff that the old one does?
That's what it sounds like to me, what you read.
I mean, how crazy is that?
I did not get that out of that. That's interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So they are going to not have any improvements from what it is now? Or they're going to go backwards on it?
It says that if you buy a Model S or a Model X that is being in production, they'll put all the stuff in there and you can buy one, but
it's not ready yet.
It's not ready.
They're not going to turn it on.
Oh, I see. So
the other thing that was very bizarre, and if anybody's interested, so on the Tesla website, they have a video of the vehicle driving, and there's the guy behind the wheel, and he's spending an inordinate amount of time with his hands like this. And I just can't imagine.
Right by the steering wheel.
And I just can't imagine, how uncomfortable it must be to be driving this. I mean, because let's face it, it's easier to just hang on to something than just to have your hands ready.
That's weird. And
for some bizarre world reason, that the soundtrack to this video is the Rolling Stones Painted Black.
Ooh, bad choice.
But I mean, it's
somebody liked Painted Black.
It's the Stones Painted Black.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is
fatalistic.
So it shows it on the freeway. It's things driving itself. And then they pull up to the Tesla headquarters. I'm assuming it's Tesla headquarters because it's an office building that says Tesla on the outside. And the guy gets out of the car, and then the car drives off by itself, and it's it appears as though it's looking for a parking space, but there are no parking spaces in the parking lot. There are all these Teslas there, which then made me think, okay, what happens to these valet cars if there is no parking space?
Did they just
drive around infinitely?
Roam.
As it turns out, it drives out of the parking lot, and there, by the side of the building on the street, it parallel parks itself. But I mean, I wonder what happens to autonomous cars with no parking spaces.
I think you got it right. They're just going to drive around like...
until they run out.
With a driver in it would do, you know? Just drive around until you find a spot.
That is weird. Yeah. I mean, there's just so many implications. You don't know what's going to happen.
What I find interesting, based on what you read, though, no LIDAR.
No LIDAR.
And yeah, Elon's against LIDAR, which mm-hmm. I don't understand whatsoever. But if they can do a fully autonomous car and they're fully confident of it without LIDAR, they've got something there that nobody else does.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting company. So we actually, last week, my magazine gave some awards for autonomous vehicles and autonomous technology, and our old friend John Krafcek came to town for it. And we had Doug Field, who is the vice president of engineering for Tesla. And what a fascinating guy this is. It turns out that he and Krafcek used to work together at Ford.
Hmm.
So, I mean, this is in the Wayback Machine, and... So this guy worked at Sikorsky, he worked at Ford, then he went to work for Segway, okay? But he went to work for Dean Kamen, actually, to work on medical devices.
Oh.
And he made that wheelchair that stands up,
yeah.
You know,
oh,
and
yeah.
I forget what the name of that thing
mm-hmm.
is. And
that's
then he
cool.
then he worked on the Segway, and then he worked at Apple, and then he's at Tesla now.
Mm.
And just to hear this guy talk about, you know, their approach to looking at things and how, you know, they don't necessarily care whether it's been done before. They don't, you know, they don't want to benchmark somebody. They just want to make as best as it can possibly be.
Yeah.
And so the limits of physics are what they worry about. They don't worry about other aspects. Oh. And
but isn't that the problem with, like, IT folks, you know, who can have failures and nobody dies?
Right.
They can have lots and lots of failures. Oh, well, that product, you know, went on fire. It's a phone. It's fine. Maybe they burnt their finger.
Yeah, but now they're
doing cars.
But, I mean, this guy worked on insulin pumps, which, I mean,
yeah,
is so he has a sense, I think, of you know, that issue there.
Yes.
But, I mean, it was such a different point of view and perspective.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And another thing that you're saying there is it sounds to me like these cars are collecting data. Because you're saying they're going to rack up X number of miles, and then they're going to be able to turn on this
right.
system. And that's one of the things with autonomous cars is, you know, right now you've got to go out and map everything that where you're going to have these cars drive. Well, once you get to fully autonomous cars with all these sensors, they can start collecting data that goes in the cloud, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is fascinating. Sounds to me like Tesla is going to collect all this data from actual owners.
Right.
And then they're going to have some degree of confidence that, at least for where you drive, sir or madam, mm-hmm. you can now put your car in fully autonomous mode.
Right. And what Tim was saying about how when you are able to have cameras that are looking ahead and
yeah.
seeing where potholes are, well, that information will be collected. That information will be sent back to the cloud. Then it'll be sent to your car because you're going to be driving down that road. And so it'll adjust.
That's amazing.
You know,
yeah.
think about that.
You just kind of see this futuristic vision of tires going,
yeah.
as
yeah.
you go.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. I mean, really, why, you know, I think we've been in this industry for so long, looking inside, having certain ways of seeing things, having the same engineers telling us the same thing, small movements, and now it's just it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy good, you know. It's not going to be a bad thing, you know. I think a lot of people in our industry take that approach, like, oh, boy, you know, no more driving. But it's just, it's a plus. Like he said, it's an and, not mm-hmm. not a, you know,
not
elimination
an
of anything.
Yeah.
And speaking of Silicon Valley and autonomy and all that, Apple looks like they're backing out of whatever automotive effort they had going big time. According to the Wall Street Journal, they laid off 150 software engineers who were working on their secret Project Titan. We think it was an autonomous electric car. Nobody knows exactly for sure. Apple's not talking. And in addition to the the 150 software engineers, the journal says they got rid of hundreds of mechanical engineers. And I wonder, has Silicon Valley blinked? You know, is this the first really back step from the huge surge into automotive that we've seen in the Valley over the last 5 years?
And did it correspond with the Tesla death issue? I mean, maybe there's a certain amount of, hey, do we really want to get into this? Is this something we want a risk in? Maybe we should do another approach to it and not building a car type of thing. But that's what I would speculate.
Well, there's two things that occurred to me. One is that that Apple will make the technology that it will then sell to automakers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other opportunity is, let's face it, I mean, Apple's got so much money, they could probably buy General Motors and still have, you know,
cash on hand.
Yeah, they'd have money for gas.
Oh, I think they should buy General Motors.
So maybe what they're saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't have to, you know, develop this car. We'll just buy a car company. I mean, there was that speculation of what was going on with McLaren, mm-hmm. right?
There was,
and they could have gotten that. They wouldn't even notice that, but. There's another thing is that maybe they looked at the thing of, you know, as we know, there aren't great margins here, you know, in this industry.
Not automotive.
Not you
not
know.
Not compared to tech.
Exactly. And therein lies, it's just like somebody maybe did the numbers and said, geez, this is maybe not such a great idea.
Yeah, but why didn't you do the numbers before you started the project?
Well, I do think there is that approach in IT where you put people on a project just to try to debunk it. And then you keep saying, well, here's why we wouldn't do it. Here's why we wouldn't do it. And if there's no reason you wouldn't do it, you move forward. It's the Google X, you know, type
right.
of thing. So they may have gotten to that point, but they sure hired a lot of people before they got to.
They did. Oh, no. I can tell you a year ago, the word on the street in Detroit is they were offering battery engineers 200. I think it was a $150,000 to $200,000 signing bonus.
Whoa.
Just to sign on. And nobody in the Detroit area, nobody in the traditional auto industry, I should say, mm-hmm. not just in Detroit, they don't pay those kind of signing
right.
bonuses. Not for battery engineers. No way.
Wow.
So they pulled a lot of people into the Apple area, and now they're letting those people mm-hmm. go. I say no worries. These people are all going to get hired. They probably had jobs before they even left the building at Apple.
Right,
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you wish
yeah.
you got that chemistry degree?
Yeah.
It's just...
But what I find interesting is that, yeah, there was all this talk that Google was going to do its own car. Now it sounds more like Google's going to provide autonomous technology to automakers.
Mm-hmm.
Apple is continuing to develop autonomous technology, even though they let all these mm-hmm. people go. It looks like they're not going to do a car. They're going to do the technology
right.
to sell to automakers. All that does is make them automotive suppliers.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're going to be competing against Delphi and Continental and others who are doing this. Plus, GM, Ford, Mercedes-Benz, Audi, Toyota are all developing their own autonomous technology. I don't see Apple or Google sticking with this at all.
Mm-hmm. All right, but look at it this way. So if you think about it, And you go buy a new PC right now, what is it generally going to have a sticker on it that says?
Intel Inside.
Intel Inside, right? So mm-hmm. now if we go back earlier, computer makers tried to do all their own chips and tried to do everything. You know, so IBM would have its own, and yeah. Intel just basically said, nah, we'll just make a business of this. So if you had a car and you were able to put a sticker on it that said Apple Inside or Google Inside, wouldn't you sort of like that better than if you were to have the name of any of the aforementioned automotive suppliers who all make great technology, but there's that certain cachet
no, there is.
That is associated.
I totally agree with you, Gary, and I think that would be a cachet. But you're an automotive supplier. You're not making 40% profit margins like you do in tech. If you're lucky...
They might.
They'll make 8%.
What if they did buy, you know, one of the big car companies that was needing to be bought? And then you'd have like a partnership that was, you know, they were the parent company, and that would really give the car company they bought some clout.
And they could do it. They could have done it a year ago easily. Mm. The point is that if you're really, 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 really good in the automotive industry as a full-line manufacturer, you make about a 10% profit margin. That's it. Apple and Google, those guys are used to 40% margins.
But once autonomous cars really catch on, it's really going to blow up the business in such a big way that maybe they would be more profitable. I don't know. It just seems to me like it changes the whole game. And that 10% is only what people who drive individual cars can make them. If it blows up into cities, buy whole fleets of cars, and, you know, there's just autonomous cars going all over the country, that explodes the profit margins. So.
That could be a loss leader if someone watches.
Yeah.
That's right. Hey, let's take another quick break right now. We got more things to talk about, but we're going to give a shout-out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back, and it's that time of the program for Dr. Data.
Yay,
Joni says.
Joni's the most excited person yeah. of all time to see this.
Right.
I've watched it so many times.
All right, so Carmen, could you please bring up the first number?
68,676,332.
No, that's so hard.
Okay. I'm going to guess. I'll take a stab at it. I'll say that's how many vehicles have been sold so far this year through September.
Damn, you're getting smart.
Is that it?
No.
Is it really?
That made it absolutely no fun for me.
Yeah. What's your guess, Joni?
Yeah.
I was going to say used car sales. I don't know.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's the number that has been sold.
68 million vehicles. So that's through nine months.
Through September, yeah. And, you know, and it's interesting. And again, this is something that Tim had mentioned earlier. So this is just purely coincidental that this comes up here. So if you look at the U.S., it's about 13 million. You look at Western Europe, it's 12 million. And you look at China, 19.4.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just really... going to town, and I mean, it's even somewhat more astonishing. And I was looking at the number just for September, okay?
Right.
So September number, 1.4 million U.S., 1.57 million in Western Europe, and 2.57 in China.
And guess what?
Wow.
In all of France last year, for the whole country, total sales were about 2.3 million. So China in 1 month sold as many cars or as sold in France for an entire year. But I'll also say this, they're headed for a crash because those sales were up, what, 30%? It was a huge jump. It was a stupid jump.
For the month? 25%.
25%. Mm. So, I mean, look, yeah. this started a year ago. Things have started to slow down in China. The government got worried. They pretty much, I think they cut the sales tax in half, and automakers started putting on incentives. The sales tax reduction expires in December. Mm. So there's a big push on in the Chinese market right now. Buy a car before this expires. So all they're doing is pulling sales forward, and I can guarantee you, unless they keep this going for a while, but even then, you'll pay for it. I think it's certainty to say sales in January and February and March in China are going to look terrible.
Well, except for the fact that yesterday there was announced a new Chinese car company that Geely came out with their...
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah. So new car brand.
But it's a new brand.
It's a new brand. Okay, so... It's,
yeah.
But it'll be... So it'll be... So Geely, the company that owns Volvo, right? Mm-hmm. So it'll position Volvo as being the luxury brand. It'll position this new company as being the middle brand, and then it'll sell Geely cars, and this is in the China domestic market, as the lower brand. Mm-hmm. So Joni, read the name of this company.
Lincoln Co.
Okay.
Or Lincoln Company.
Okay.
I don't know which.
And then leave the company part
Lincoln
out.
Lincoln or Link?
Link. I pronounce it Link, but it's probably not.
Well, but just think, see, this is the thing that sort of struck me. Say the leave the company part off and just say it really fast.
Link.
No, and the
Oh, Link ampersand?
Yeah, but what is...
Oh, Link and?
Link and Company?
Right.
Lincoln.
It sounds Lincoln. Like Lincoln.
It sounds like Lincoln.
The Lincoln Motor Car Company.
Yes.
Link
does.
And Motor Car. You know, it's well, sort of unusual.
Maybe they think, see, okay, maybe but, someone wouldn't notice that, oh, well, this is a Lincoln.
So, okay, company. So the first vehicle they're going to come out with is called the 01.
There's a real thought.
It's the first car.
They put a lot of thought into that, is what I'm trying to say.
Interbrand was not involved.
It's an SUV, okay, naturally, right? I mean, because that's what's being sold, and it looks it looks suspiciously.
We're giggling at
it. It looks suspiciously like
here.
A. Kia Sportage to me, but because they showed the car yesterday, and they're going to have a Tesla-like buying experience where basically they will have stores, not dealerships, at least in Europe and China. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're not here for a while.
They're not here for like maybe until 2019, but they're talking next year in China, and. It'll be, you know, a fixed price thing, and then they're gonna open it up so that software developers can make apps for the car, right? So you'd be able to have your own app, and then another idea that they're talking about is that so there's the car.
Yeah, it's got those funny lights.
So that it would be built so you might be able to share your car with your neighbors when you're not using it, that you could do it, and they're gonna set it up with digital keys, so you could have a digital key, and Joni, you could have a digital key, I could have a digital key, and we would share this thing, but you know, I get back to the thing when I started thinking about this, it's like, okay, why did they start a new brand?
Yeah,
I mean,
i.e., why not just have Geely and Volvo?
Right.
You know, like Lexus and Toyota.
Right. I mean what is it?
Why
the
do
advantage?
You need three?
What is Geely to the Chinese market? I mean, what kind of a brand is it? Has it been around a long time? I don't know because...
Well, Geely, the company, has been around a while. I mean, nothing automotive in China has been around a whole long time, right?
Right, right.
And I can't remember the names of them. I want to say they had three different brands that they were operating with. And then the guy who owns the whole thing, this billionaire named Li Shufu, said, no, we're going to have one brand. And he sort of slammed these three different brands together, and they've been using the Geely brand that I want to say, and I'm not hyper up to their full model line, but I want to say they probably top out in China in the $35,000, $36,000 range, with the Geely line.
Yeah, that is odd that they would have a middle range and have Volvo as their... top range.
I'm trying to get that to be premium. So I was looking at brands or divisions, however we want to look at this, that have had some success but remarkably short lives. The Eagle. Remember Eagle?
Oh, I remember the Eagle, yeah.
Right? The AMC Eagle, right?
Well, you know, they created that brand because if you remember when Chrysler bought American Motors, all it really wanted was Jeep, but it also got and committed to buying cars from the old Renault operations, I want to say for a couple of years. And so they had, what was it? It was the Eagle Premier, sort of a boxy sedan thing. And they went, well, you know, it doesn't fit in the Dodge lineup. It doesn't fit in the Plymouth lineup. It doesn't fit in the Chrysler lineup. What are we going to do? So they created this new brand called Eagle. It was solely to take these AMC-developed products, or Renault actually developed products, and sell them under something.
10 years, 88 to 98. Saturn. 20 years.
Yeah, Saturn's a sad one.
So 90 to 10. Now this is one I didn't realize had such a short life. Rambler.
Oh, Rambler. I was
really?
Probably, yeah, mid-50s to what? I don't think it made it to the 70s,
nope.
Did it?
58 to 69. Kaiser, which was also part of that thing.
Right.
47 to 55. But we'll bring it into the future.
Thank you.
Aptera.
I know the guy that designed that. I spent some time with him as a consulting thing. Yeah. He's really sad that it didn't work out.
Well, Aptera never made it to the market.
No, it was never.
But it was a company.
It had
a vehicle.
I would say they were probably in business 5 years.
He's a teacher at Art Center.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So there we have an Aptera there. So
yes, yeah.
05 to 11.
Justin Bell.
Okay, and the last one, another vehicle from your part of the world, Coda.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes, Coda.
Coda. In fact, I even have on one of the shelves in my offices sort of a replica Coda battery. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, they had some good battery technology, actually. And but they went and bought this.
It looks like an Eagle Premier.
It's a hideous car. It was like a three-generation-old Mitsubishi Galant or something like that was still being made in China.
Yeah,
and
really
they said, this is the car for the future. And I mean, look at it. It was so outdated before it even hit. And yeah, they sold a few. They did sell some Codas.
I just think of Larkin, my friend, who worked for Mercedes and went to Coda.
Right.
Wow, you're driving... habits have probably really changed.
Yeah, well, there was also a very top-level GM executive who ended up there, Phil Murtaugh, who ran all of GM's China operations.
Wow.
And I think I can tell the story now. You know, he pulled me aside at the launch of that Coda sedan with that three-generation-old Mitsubishi, and he says, I got to the program too late. I would have never gone with this. He wanted to go with Great Wall, which makes crossovers, SUVs. He wanted to do that. He said Great Wall was one of the best independent car companies in China. But, I guess they brought Phil Murtaugh on too late because the car they went with bombed completely.
Mm. So Coda 09 to 13, that was it.
I didn't even know it was that long.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So there you go, that you start these new things and they don't necessarily work out. Well, even Scion, right? I mean, you'd make the argument that...
Well, remember Geo?
Geo, that's right.
Geo was a
Chevrolet sub-brand
that was
aimed at Toyota, and it didn't work.
It just seems to me that the big three of Detroit just are the cautionary tale of just starting up brands and then just building all these brands up, and then, we have to just take these out. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that could be what has brought us to, it happens fewer times, and I think it's especially... I don't know, pedantic or something. It's not good when people start a brand that's supposed to be for young people because I think that whole idea Scion had, you know. And then it was Florida Plus who were the only ones buying Scions or, you know, for the most part. Mm-hmm. Because it's just young people don't usually buy new cars anyway. And now the habits are, you know, they get a family and a job and they go right to a nice SUV. They don't go to a little compact car, then graduate. And then, you know, so you certainly don't want to build a brand around that concept.
Or, or they'll buy a used BMW.
Yes, exactly. So I just think that whole thing is antiquated.
You're right. Well, I'll give you another one that was short-lived. Mercure.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was a Bob Lutz creation. Mercure, of course, is the German for Mercury, and it was a sub-brand to Mercury.
Right.
And they had the XR4 that they brought over from Europe, and then the Scorpio. Mm-hmm. And again, they botched the launches of those cars like you couldn't believe, and they died a stillborn death. But I want to say they were around for 3 or 4 years, and then Mercure was gone.
Right. Well, what do you think of Genesis? Because having an alma mater, I was once a Hyundai employee. To me, it's very interesting to see them finally come out with this luxury brand or premium brand. But I think they've done a pretty good job so far of kind of setting expectation for it, maybe not reaching higher than they ought to.
Well, look. You know, Hyundai has wanted a luxury brand for years.
Yes.
Now they finally got it. They're not going to give up. Mm-mm. The Koreans are not going to give up until they make this thing work.
Yeah.
So I think 20 years from now, we'll be talking about the Genesis brand still. They've got Lexus right in their crosshairs. That's what they want to emulate, what Lexus was able to achieve. And it's not going to be easy. It's going to take them a long time. But unlike the American car companies, when things don't turn into instant success, the Koreans aren't going to give up.
But you know what's interesting about that company is that the G90 that they're launching with was, you know, just an extraordinary sedan. But, you know, you look at big sedan sales, and they just are going in the wrong direction.
Right? Not in China.
Well,
everyone's going to cross over.
But, I mean,
absolutely.
Just say for the argument here, you know what I mean? So, the guys there are all saying, you know, the cadence of when products were coming out that we really wish we were launching, that we had a couple of, you know, we had an SUV and a, you know, a midsize crossover. And they're coming. They're in the plans.
Right.
But, you know, wouldn't that be nice to be able to launch with one of those things that's going up? I mean, you look at the Cadillac numbers. I mean, you know, so you mm-hmm. look at Escalade is doing, you know, exceedingly well and has been for quite a while. And the XT5, is that
mm-hmm.
the right?
Yeah, XT5, right. That's the rest.
Not as good a name as 01, but no. I mean, but you know, I mean, close. and those sales are going, you know. So I mean, that's the, you know, Lincoln with the MKC. I mean, that's
look at Jaguar. You know, they got the F-Pace and the XE. Mm-hmm. The XE is the sedan. It's selling. And F-Pace is off to the races.
Yes,
you look at
absolutely.
Volvo. Yeah, S90, you know, they're selling some.
Mm-hmm.
And the XC90 is, which is a crossover, off to the races.
It's so interesting that, you know, these are the kinds of things when you've been in the business for many decades, you can't believe happened.
Right.
Can you believe that a flagship is not going to be a sedan?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be an SUV. And
right.
even Hyundai had to come out with plans and drawings and, you know, things of their upcoming SUVs when they launched the Genesis brand, because
right.
without that, you're not even playing in the mm-hmm. in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Well, I just got to drive the G90, and that is one serious sedan.
Oh, that's very, very nice car.
You know what, though? That car makes me think it's going less after Lexus and more after a big Cadillac. It's just got that hefty boat kind of with tons of hardware, you know, type of thing. When you compared to the German look and feel, especially in the interior, it's very metally and heavy and kind of, it has so much more heft in the way that Cadillac has heft and less so that, you know, maybe, I don't know. We'll see. I think you're
Cadillac
right.
Cadillac is all about lightweight.
Lightening it up. But I do think that we will see more about Genesis when we see the SUVs come out, and mm-hmm. just how they'll compete and where the pricing is, because it came in a little high, I thought, in the high 60s, the G90.
Mm-hmm.
And that went from Equus in the low 60s.
Right. No, I think they're pricing it more against an S-Class Mercedes, actually.
Yeah.
And
to
price
be less
to it,
than, yeah.
this, you know, the G90 looks like something of a bargain. But
mm-hmm.
and if you look back when Lexus launched the original LS400 sedan, they priced it at about that kind of a gap to an S-Class.
Yeah.
So I think that's the game plan that mm-hmm. that Genesis is following.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you don't see a Coda-like future for the Genesis?
For Genesis?
Brand.
No. the Koreans, they'll commit suicide before they give up on trying to make this brand work.
I think it would be ironic if Genesis named their flagship the 01. Genesis 01. Oh, no. That's my joke. That's all I got.
Hey, look, we've burned up an hour here. We're probably going to have to bring it to an end, unfortunately.
It was fun.
But, Joni, thanks
so
much for coming here. It was great to
have you.
I hope
to be back. We're working on a future date.
All right. Fantastic.
We'll have to talk about advertising in the future.
Oh, yeah.
That'll be fun.
Yeah,
because
that's
advertising.
Your background.
Yes.
Yeah, you know advertising. Yeah, we'll have to do that
for
sure.
We'll do that for sure.
Good.
See, I got it on camera, so now we have to.
Committed.
That's real good. Well, Gary, good seeing you.
Okay.
We'll keep on doing this.
Maybe next week.
Why not?
All right.
Okay.
Sounds like a plan.
Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.